David Bohm Seminar Series 2, Sunday, December 3rd, 1989, 10 o'clock morning session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California. This particular tape involves a momentary loss of material at the very beginning. To summarize this loss, Dr. Bohm began the morning by picking up the thread of the previous evening's discussion on the nature of impulse. The tape begins in the midst of this topic, focusing on the elements involved in an infant's impulse to touch or not to touch fire.
It would be like his name, so he wouldn't have to think, huh? He would see a bright object. Now, one of these might be a fire he'd never seen before. He'd reach and burn himself. Right? Now, then there would be the memory both of pleasure and pain, right? The pleasure of bright objects and the pain. Right? So the next time he starts reaching, the pleasure makes him reach is the impulse to reach, right? The anticipated pleasure. And the pain is the impulse to stop. Right? Mm-hmm. So he's sort of balanced. suspending it, right? And now that might cause the whole impulse to turn back into the memory. The impulse to act is turned to the impulse to search the memory, right? For a solution to this, you know, right? So he may search the memory and find out a memory that the fire was pleasant when it wasn't too close and painful when it was closer. And therefore, he finds a solution, right? And then the next action is to move a reasonable distance from the fire. Right, not get too close, huh? You see, so you can see that something pleasurable is an impulse to act, something painful may be an impulse to stop, right? But it may be an impulse to turn around. And see, we call thought reflection, which means turning around, right? We reflect the impulse to act outwardly into an impulse to turn inward to search the memory. That comes out again, and if it's not satisfactory, it goes right back in again. It keeps reflecting, right? You see, so you can see that thought that suggests anyway pretty convincingly that thought goes by some sort of impulse to search the memory. That's elementary thought anyway, right? Now it may also contain an impulse to ask a question or to do other things, you know, to watch for incoherence.
Could we say that thought has the impulse to stimulate the intellect?
Well, that's what it does. By going, the first impulse is to search the memory. That's the beginning of the stimulation of the intellect, right?
Right.
Now, if the memory doesn't have an answer, then it must have an impulse to do something else, right? Let's say to think in a more creative way, right?
Now, what we're doing is we're trying to see this impulse in action, right?
Yeah.
Now, if one of the mistakes or thing might need to be examined is, does thought end in our body? Is there a larger thought in the group?
If we start talking about it together, it goes out,
right,
and comes back, right? It's still the same thought, right?
So if we only searched within our body for this impulse, we might also be missing a lot.
Yeah, well, for example, if I ask you a question, the impulse has come from me, right, in the first instance. And then you may not even have time to think, but you answer, you see, which means you develop an impulse from what I say, right? The memory responds so fast, you see, you hardly can notice it as an impulse. Huh?
So the idea that this impulse might even be something that I'm doing, I mean, I keep thinking, I was trying to particularize it as a little spot, like a button that was being pushed or something, and now I'm seeing it as this, that there isn't. It's this big, huge movement.
Yes. Yes, it gives rise to an impulse, and as Eccles showed, for example, you may have an intention to do something, but electrical activity is going on in the brain before you actually know that intention, right? That gathers from heaven knows where, you see, but part of it may gather from the memory or from somebody, what somebody said, or...
Well, it reacts from a bunch of different
things. Yeah. And you see, so that begins to show that the process, see, this picture that I decide everything that's going to happen is not right.
Hmm? That seems to be the error.
Yeah.
That I'm looking for that place in me that's deciding.
Yes, but it's going on, you see. It's an ongoing process. And so you have all these impulses, and you can begin to watch them, you see, to say, or even bring them up. Say, you see, if you go into anger, for example, and stir up the words that make you angry, the feeling you get in the solar plexus or the chest or wherever it is almost, is in effect an impulse to keep on thinking those thoughts, right?
Right. Mm.
So you have that cause becomes effect, and effect becomes cause, right? You can't make a linear chain of cause and effect. Mm. So you can't say, let's find the cause and get rid of the effect, right? Because the effect is already also the cause, right? It's, so we need another approach, right? You see that somehow you have to approach cause and effect together.
Hmm? It's more like a net.
Yes.
Or a web. In which a vibration, one part of the web, vibrates through the whole web.
Yes, it all goes together. So cause becomes effect, effect becomes cause. It all gets set up as a constant process. In which they're sort of opposed to each other, or balancing each other or something. And in that constant process, you see, we don't have to go back to the past. You see, I'm saying another mistake you could make is I've got to find the cause and an impulse I had in the past, right? You'll never find that because it's gone. But there's an impulse right now. Because this is a continuing process, cause and effect are together in a continuing process. So the impulse is present, right?
Like two symbols, when you clap them together, you can call one cause and one effect, but it's the noise that
really is the thing. Yes, well, there are two sides, one's called cause and the effect, and you can turn them around, right?
Is there a way of drawing a picture or of defining what an impulse is? I mean, is it a physiological occurrence or is it a mental occurrence?
Well, it's a kind of a feeling you get that makes you want to do something, you see.
Right. Mm.
Now, sometimes you can catch it, right?
Right. But it is a feeling, then. It's something that's...
It's an urge. Another word for it is urge, right?
Yeah, so it's more mental than physical.
Yeah, there's the word urge, impulse. The word impulse is the way the word impel, right? Pushing you. Now, I would like to discuss. We discussed thought and thinking and thought, feeling and felt, thinkings and thoughts, feelings and felts. I could introduce two words instead of the word impulse, just for thinking about them. The word impelling, impellings and impels. There's an impelling that goes on, you know, from the fresh perception. There are all the impels in your memory which work, right? Right. You see, but it's hard to distinguish them, you see. So you may take an impelled and judge it to be an impelling, right? You see, we even use the word, this is an impelling reason, right? So suppose you have an impelling reason to do something, then it suggests that out of that impelling reason arises an impulse that is impelling you, pushing you, right? You get a feeling of being pushed, of being urged, or even a drive, right? These are different words for this same sort of thing.
Would impellings, or the past one, the impelled, be particulars that we, as a memory, but impelling is a broader...
Yeah, well, impelling is the present process. Right?
It's just the process in itself.
So what you perceive may impel you to do something, maybe an impelling, right? But it may be that it evokes an impelled, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the conditioning doesn't come in until after the...
Well, the impelled may be part of the conditioning. You see, if you're programmed with an impelled, then when something happens, it jumps up and you're pushed, right? You have a compulsive urge. That's the same root. To compel and impel are the same thing, right?
But I thought you said that it had nothing to do with the past.
What? Well, I'm saying that you don't have to go back to the original impulse to understand this because it's constantly being recreated, right?
Mm-hmm. Hmm? What is the original?
The what? The what?
The original impulse.
Well, we don't know. I mean, it's been going on for ages, you know. One leads to another, you know. It's like a stream. It's just going on, you see. And Now, the point is then that this process, you can see, is self-generated. It goes on by itself, right?
Mm-hmm. But it comes out of our conditioning.
And it also adds to it.
And it adds to it.
Every time it goes into the memory, you add some more, right?
So every time there's an impelled,
mm-hmm.
you create more conditioning. You add more to
yes.
that layer that we're stuck in.
Yeah.
In a broader context, couldn't this impulse or being impelled be from the loss of thread of thought? Well, like a servo system that sets up stability on a ship. If a wave hits the ship in one side, the servo system immediately brings the system back to stability. If something happens on the other side, it immediately brings the system back to stability. Well, in a sense that manifestation depends upon I've lost the thread of what I was saying. Our basis of existence, which is manifestation, depends upon our ability to detect changes in an environment. Like if I look over and that speaker isn't there, well, immediately I see that something's wrong or something I don't understand. I look around and God's in his heaven and it's all right with the world. The trees are there and the sunshine and the continuity of activity is what I expect to happen. And I project into the future how we're going to end the meeting and then we're going back home. Everything has a continuity. Well, if something happens in this continuity which is not expected, not in the program, so to speak, that brings in a shock.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a noise, then what is that noise? Because there's a constant desire to maintain this continuity. So in a sense, we create the world every second mm-hmm. by this constant desire to survive. I mean, it's a desire to survive as an individual. If I don't create this context, this continuity, then I don't survive. So this, in a sense, I've got to, not I, but, yes, I, this entity, which is me, has to create me by this constant activity, tremendous expenditure of energy to maintain this image, so to speak.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is happening a million sensory perceptions a moment, and each one has to be resolved in terms of this survival. Does that make any sense?
Well, that's something that we can come to discuss. You know, we discuss the ego or the self.
Mm.
You see, but. See, this we're discussing is the thought process which underlies that. You see that what I mean by thought is not just the intellect, remember, but all the rest, and that there's a whole process going on which may get involved in the urge to survive. You see, there is an impulse to survive. We call it the survival instinct, but then thought takes that up, right, and begins to expand it. And makes all sorts of things survive which have nothing to do with your real survival, right?
I think he's talking about the survival of the ego.
That's right, that's what I mean. But it begins with the impulse to survive physically, which you could say is built into us.
Well, not necessarily physically. It's this image, self-image,
yeah.
which is to survive the the physical structure,
yeah,
is independent of this desire to maintain, like I'm trying to be, in a sense, intelligent, and I've got to put on a show which maintains, in my opinion, what I think of myself. And I don't want to make a fool of myself. I want to maintain what I think I should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a whole criteria for being me, which is part of the world.
Yes, so, it comes from the society, right?
It's a constant defense and offense. I've got to maintain my divinity, so to speak. You've got to keep your distance from me. You can't insult me. I mean, this whole criteria about what I demand in order for me to exist as a, yeah, as this entity.
Yeah, well, we have to go into all that. What is this entity, you see, and what does it mean, right? I say that we know that there is an inbuilt impulse to survive physically, and thought can take that up, you see, and say, I identify myself with the physical, with the mental, we'll discuss that, and I've got to survive with the internal image as well. So it can spread to that, you see. Now, we probably should come to that, you know, as we go along, discussing the self or the ego, which has got to survive, right? Now the thing, there's the thought of the absolute necessity of it surviving.
What? Which is a tremendous, tremendous force.
Yeah, well, but necessity is the most powerful force there is, right?
Well, this is the basis for the world, actually.
Well, the world of society, right? Yeah.
But it only exists so I can be me.
Well, that's the thought says that. You see, I mean, what we're discussing is the certain structure of thoughts, which are not just yours, but they are sort of shared over the whole society, right?
Yeah.
We have all that, but you see, all those thoughts contain impulses or impels, right? Very compulsive impels, right? That is, you have a sense of compulsion to think that way, which is part of the necessity, right? You experience necessity as inner compulsion to go on with this, right? So we have to get into that. But I think we'd have to discuss the nature of the self a bit more before we could go very far. Maybe we'll get to it a little bit later. But meanwhile, we have to see that there is a process going on which is more fundamental than that self. It's in the whole nature of thought, right? There's something underlying it. See, we try to get the underlying process to begin with, and then thought is part of that. The self is part of that, right?
The self in what context?
Well, the one you were describing.
The self-image.
Yeah. The self-image is thought, you see.
Yes.
And therefore it's part of thought. Now, if we can see how thought works, that lays a foundation for seeing how the self-image works. But if you try to jump into the self-image, you have no foundation.
How are we distinguishing between the impulse and the impulsion and compulsion?
Well, com means together. See, compulsion is somewhat stronger, right? It's the same sort of thing, but it's stronger, right? But somebody can compel you from outside, which means he is pushing on you to do something, right? But he really is trying to drive you from inside as well. That is, the compulsion is exerted inwardly by getting you to do it, right? So he's trying to take control of your impulse in a way. But you also have compulsive urges of your own, which can take control of the others, or take priority, right? That is one of the means of which necessity works, right? That it's the sense of not yielding, right? The compulsion, strong impelled or compulsion means don't yield, right? Which means necessity.
When you use the word compulsion, I have a reaction that says, be wary of this. Compulsions come out of our neuroticism.
That's true, but thought is neurotic. You see, I'm trying to say the whole structure of human thought is neurotic. That's the problem. If thought were not neurotic, it would be very different. That is, the basic structure of thought as it has evolved over a long period of time is neurotic, right? It's not that the individual is neurotic, it is thought that is neurotic, right? The individual is infected with the neuroticism of thought, right?
One of the neurotic things of thought is that there is an individual.
That what?
One of the neurotic aspects of thought is the idea that I am an individual.
Well, in some sense, but I mean, let's say that in some sense you are, in some sense you aren't, in the sense.
Well, as thought is concerned.
The self-image is identified with individuality. So your body is distinct, right?
But it isn't that that's causing the problem.
No. But nevertheless, there's a confusion, as we'll see, between the self-image and the body. You see, they sort of merge.
Right.
So it's not quite so simple.
This thought we're talking about is a very large thought that I just happen to be a part of. It's not my thought.
It's anybody. It's the whole general thought. You see,
right.
It's a kind of... it's like viruses circulating around, you see, which may infect anybody.
So the idea that I have my own thoughts is a little neurotic.
Well, you could say it's your cold, if you like, your flu. You see, or it's Asian flu or somebody's flu, right? But you see, but it's just flu, right?
Right.
The thing is that you nourished it, your body nourished it, right?
Yeah.
So your mind nourishes all these thoughts, that's...
Right.
And therefore you catch them, right? You could say we've caught this neurotic thought, right?
Does neurosis actually mean a disease of the neuron?
Well, that's what the word means, but I'm saying it probably doesn't mean that really. It means the neurophysiological process is really upset by a neurosis, but I don't know, you couldn't associate it to a neuron, right?
Are images on the neurons at all?
Well, the neurons will fire whenever they're images, you see. They're inseparable. So if you have a lot of incoherence, the neurons are going to be opposed to each other and wear themselves out and so on, right?
So it becomes a neurosis.
Yeah.
Are you in a sense saying that there is this thing? Like, we have a sense that we invented thought, but in a way you're saying it's like there.
Thought invented us. I turn
right.
It around.
So we use it because it's there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not because we want it or something.
Yeah.
We don't even use it. It uses us.
It uses
right.
us. We have not learned to use it as an instrument, you see. Except in a limited way, right? So, you see, I'm saying, if you watch how impulses, urges, compulses, all that goes, you see thought produces impulses, and impulses produce thought. They go as cause becomes effect, effect becomes cause, right? There's no linear chain saying, I am the cause of my thought, right?
And then one begins to see that, as one watches that.
But the whole tradition of our culture is, you are, each person is the cause of his thought, right?
The word impulse and compulsion confuse me. Are we suggesting that impulse in and of itself is destructive?
No, you can't live without it, right?
Okay, and compulsion, is that being suggested?
Well, that could be more dangerous, right?
Okay.
Yeah, it usually has some irrational element in it, right?
Yeah. So impulse in and of itself may be fine.
Yeah.
It's what happens... Without our being sensitive to it or whatever, it gets carried away into the intellect. Is that
yes, well, also we have thought has a wrong idea of how it works by saying that impulses are me, and I am the cause of the whole thing. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I choose my impulses. I choose my thoughts.
Yeah.
I choose it all. Right?
Yeah.
Now that is the wrong theory of this whole thing. Right.
Yeah.
Now when thought has a wrong theory about how it works, that makes thought work wrongly.
Yeah.
Even a good bit of our conditioning is not a problem in itself. It's our not being aware of it.
Yes, the conditioning we have to have, you see. Some of it, right? You see, like when you learn to walk or drive a car, there's a great deal of conditioning, the language, right? But there is irrational, incoherent conditioning, right?
But you could be conditioned to think that it could be stored and rain it. In this situation, there's urgency.
Yeah.
Maybe not compulsion, which may be true.
Oh, yes. Well, for example, you say if a child doesn't know about electric wires, so he has to be taught that it's urgent to avoid them, right? So there has to be an impulse in there to be aware, right?
Yeah.
You see, so we need this conditioning and so on, but the question is, it isn't working coherently.
The compulsion has an added aspect to it. It's as if there was a feeling that there was something lacking and I have to do this in order to set things right. And that's sort of just a little bit too much.
Yes, it's violent in a way. You see, compulsion has violence in it, right? An undue use of force, right?
Yeah.
There are various things that are, you know, undue in thought, and it's the undue use of force in this case. Now, we have to see, and this impulse, this compulsive impulse, may be very subtle. You may not notice it. You see, it's a lot of little things go on in the mind, little sensations, which are in a way impulses, mm-hmm. which we may assume are harmless. You see. Harmless little impulses, but they may not be so harmless. They may be the impulses to think thoughts that are deceptive, right? They're the impulse to make things a little easier, right? But then the way it works is, you see, if you have an impulse to make things a little easier, then the mind searches for the way of making it a little easier, and it may search in this level of tacit thought, like the bicycle riding, moving this way and that way. When it finds a little move that makes it easier, it says, let's move a little more that way, and so on. It may be that move is a move toward a thought that's comforting, but wrong. Huh? Mm-hmm. You see? So, you see, there may be some very subtle impulses there which lead to self-deception, right? Mm-hmm. And that can be very dangerous, right? See, self-deception can be, it turns thought into something very dangerous. That requires sensitivity, right? So you have these impulses, and see, there's the move, see, at a certain neurophysiological level, instinctively, there's the move toward whatever is pleasurable and away from what is painful. Now, this is common to the animal level. At the animal level, it works fairly well. Now, but then thought takes that up, right? Now, the difficulty is thought can produce felts of pleasure and pain, right? From the memory. So a certain thought produces a felt of pain, and then comes a demand or an impulse, you know, get rid of it, right? Move to get rid of it. So a movement takes place in this subtle, tacit level, which makes thought work, right? To find the move that decreases the pain, so it moves to a comforting thought, right? So thought creates the problem of pain and then moves to remove the it makes another move to get rid of it, but the two moves don't cancel each other, they add up to self-deception, right?
These are the impulses that really need to be seen, not so much the body ones, but these ones where thought starts getting itself moving in a kind of self-deceptive action of, I have this problem, I'm going to solve this problem. That sounds to me like the kind of definition of neurosis.
Yeah. See, that's the beginning of the whole neurotic structure, you see, that the move toward, Freud called it the pleasure-pain principle. You see, the basic principle at the animal level is pleasure-pain, right? Toward pleasure, away from pain, right? At the tacit movement level. Huh? Mm-hmm. And then with thought, that gets into trouble, right? Because thought can produce felts of pleasure and pain, you see. If you move and have a toothache and you move to reduce it in some way, that may make sense. Or, you know, if your body is uncomfortable and you move to make it comfortable. But if you, let's say I've been hurt, I have pain, and I move to get rid of it, I say, well, I'll never be hurt again that way, or I'll never see that person. Or, you know, I'll think thoughts about him saying he's wrong, you know, all sorts of thoughts. I'll get even with him. You know, revenge is sweet. The sweet thought of revenge removes the pain, right? But then it means you're in trouble, because if you start, that leads you on to some very dangerous actions. So if you don't act, you're frustrated. Huh? So now, see, thought introduces the pain of frustration, saying, I ought to be taking revenge and I haven't had a chance. Or else I shouldn't be taking revenge, but I want to.
So what you're saying is that we've set up our, you said there's a pleasure pain, and we're predicating our experience of pleasure on coming up with an image which gives us that sense.
That's right. Now that's the beginning of neurosis, you see. Now Freud mentioned the idea of the reality principle, which is that, you know, you ought to go according to reality rather than pleasure and pain, right? But you see, the trouble is people can't do it, right?
In a way, you can be forced to do it in the sense that if you have a bad toothache and you've taken codeine, and suddenly you take the codeine and it makes you sick, you have to stop taking it. You can't.
Well, sometimes you do. That's true. Sometimes you are forced into the reality principle. But on the whole, the movement is the tacit movement that's unconscious is moved toward the pleasure, right? And away from the pain, right? To move, find thoughts that make you feel better, and you see, if people are hurt and they think about revenge, and they don't say, "Well, what move can you make?" You see, revenge would be sweet, but it's dangerous, and you're still hurt, right? So you're still hurting yourself all the time. Now that's the problem, right?
There doesn't seem to be much of a reality principle in psychological matter.
Yeah, it seems you can very hard to get into any reality principle. We don't even know what this reality is, right?
And we think that the psychological matters are the reality.
Yeah. So it doesn't seem to help you to talk about a reality principle.
Do you think that Maslow's hierarchy of needs has any validity?
For the human
being psychologically?
There are needs, but if you cannot be clear on what you're doing, you don't know what you're doing. You see, I say I need revenge. That's what the meaning right now.
A status need, and Maslow thinks it's intrinsic to human beings.
Why?
To keep pressing for an equilibrium in status.
Yeah, so I'm not sure it's intrinsic. I think it may be a way of thinking. You see, a way of thought, rather. That I would say I need revenge because I've been hurt. I feel uncomfortable.
Or I may need to go someplace else to get what I need. I can't get it here.
Well, that may be, but if revenge is what I need, I won't. I don't know. I've got to get it somewhere. You see, or else I could go and say, "I'll show them." You see, I'll go somewhere else and show them that I.
Or you can kick the dog.
You can kick the dog. None of this makes any sense. You're still hurt. You see, the machine is still there hurting you, right?
No, there's a way of alleviating it by some kind of further action.
Yes, but then because it's still on the program, it acts again and again. You haven't got rid of the program, right. So it doesn't get very far.
Right.
So that at that level, it's all self-deception that's operating?
Basically self-deception, because you don't know the source of the trouble. You see, you're treating the symptom and not the cause, mm-hmm. in this case.
So you can come up with a great way that you think is going to alleviate what the problem is on a psychological level.
Yeah, see, somebody may...
Reinforcing it.
Yeah, somebody may say, "Look, we've been treated very badly. We want to have a war and have revenge. It would be wonderful. We have this war and it creates such destruction. We wish we hadn't had it, right?" Mm-hmm.
Well, this thing called need has quite a powerful statement, and I'm not so sure that this need really exists in the first place that we're reacting to when we kick it off.
Yeah, well, that's a notion of necessity. So I wonder if we could introduce two new words. Say needings and neededs. You see that from the past, I am needing something now, really, such as I'm hungry, or they're all the neededs. You see, which are on my program. I've been hurt in the past, and those neededs are operating, saying I must get some relief. It could be revenge. I could say I'll show them. Maybe they'll apologize. Mm-hmm. You know, all sorts of ways of relieving it, but. The thing is on the program. You see, it's like saying instead of removing the program, we've got to arrange our whole lives so as to try to relieve what's coming out of that program, you see.
Yeah. Is there a Dr. Bone dictionary available?
Well, the principle is very simple, you see. You add ING or ED, right? You see that that's a fundamental distinction. Is it something in the now or is it from the past, right? Mm.
Well, I'm still very confused. Do you, what is the ground of the human being? Are there intrinsic needs? You seem to say only the need to eat and sleep.
No, it is more than that.
I can't figure out which mores you have.
Yes, well, I think it would be hard to define them, but people need order, they need coherence, they need beauty, they need friendship and love, they need various things, you see, but they don't need revenge, you see. Not really. I think it's on the program. You see that that they need it like we need a hole in the head, as they say. That, that if you're hurt, it's not a genuine need. It's like the computer is telling you you need something, right?
When you're hurt, I think it comes out of a need for order, and that is not that you want revenge, but you need to put back in order. And this is a small order, a psychological order. You have to order it. You have to correct the situation, whether it's revenge or whether it's because I'm hungry or whatever. And I think that we mistake the maybe more of a physiological order with the psychological order. That seems to me a more...
Well, I think there's another order involved, which is the difference between memory and actuality. You see, something has happened in the past which has left a program which works and stirs up the nerves and makes you feel uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable, and you want to seek order, so you're
That's right. But you're going about it the wrong way.
The wrong way.
You see.
But if you see that you are in a state of needing order...
Yes, then you're... That's right.
Okay.
But the order you need is to get rid of that program.
That's right. Right.
But what you're seeing as order that you want to get back to may in fact be disorder.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, because you don't see the cause of the... you don't see the difference between cause and effect. You see that... The program is the source of the thing. Now, the program can produce felts. You see, we don't notice that. That's one of our tradition says feelings are all genuine and real, and when you feel something, you need it, right? But I say, no, that's not always so. Some of these things are felts. And you just, you see, like somebody says, you're itching to do something, you see. Now, this itch could be produced by felts, right? By just the machine making your nerves itch. All sorts of things could make your nerves itch, right? And this sort of program, which in the memory is somewhere, just remembers how to stir up the nerves that create an itch, right? In fact, if you can create an itch by thinking of an itch, right? You just think for a while, and you can make the muscle, the skin itch, right?
Oh, yeah.
You see, so where does it come from? In the memory, there's a program as to how to make the nerves itch. It's remembered. And you finally fish around and feel around for a while until you stir it up and by this tacit process, and that starts to itch. And as it itches a little more, you move more in that direction of whatever you were doing, and then build it up, right? You see, now that has no meaning, really. It's not a need. You would say, my need is to stop this itch and scratch, right? But the more you scratch, the more it's going to itch, right? Mm-hmm. You see, that's not the immediate... So you say that the real need is to stop doing this sort of neurotic thing or this crazy thing, right?
Dr. Baum,
yeah.
What is your program for getting rid of these unwanted programs?
Well, we're coming to that. You see, there's not a program for doing it, but I'm going to suggest... things we can do which will help in that direction, right?
Actually, it doesn't happen until tomorrow.
it's mostly implicit, so it will be tomorrow.
Did you have any use to find out how the program was started?
What?
Did you have any use for us to ask how the program was started?
Well, we know how it started. It went into the memory, you see. We did all sorts of things in the past, the whole human race, and it was remembered and passed on from one generation to another.
So why is the child so easily imprinted, and then when we're adults, it's so hard to reprint?
Well, that's the way it goes. You see that a child is open, very, you know, very impressionable. It's got to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead of the parents giving it some sensible impressions, it gives it all this neuroticism.
Instead of the parent, in some sense, fostering that movement of openness.
Yeah.
We teach closeness.
Yes, we teach all these things I've been talking about, you see.
But and we succeed.
What?
You can't not teach, you can't not let a child come to conclusions. You can't.
No, but we teach it to do all these wrong things like nationalism and hate and, you know, and well, all sorts of things we've been talking about, like... not understanding the difference between thoughts and felts and so on, you see. Tremendous confusion, right?
We hand them over conclusions rather than letting them develop conclusions on their own that are only temporary for that particular thing. We impose on them. So they never develop, they never find it out for themselves and go through that tacit learning.
I think it's a part of the process. I mean, an infant forms conclusions of when mother is going to come. You can't take a child and not see conclusions being formed.
Well, some conclusions are formed, and you've got to form some, but some of these are the conclusions that cause trouble are those about the nature of the thought-felt process and the meanings of all that. You know, what about being hurt and about being angry and about what sort of thoughts you should have and what sort of feelings you should have and so on. I see a vast number of things are all sorts of violence which is going on, which is impressed on the child.
So we're saying that some conclusions are good and some conclusions are bad.
Well, the conclusions that could be opened up are all right. You see, there are conclusions that are absolute and saying you must never absolutely play with that sort of child, you see, because he's no good, right? He's the wrong group, right? You see.
See, what I'm wondering is the process deeper than that, that there is a natural state to form absolute conclusions that's not imposed from the parent.
That's probably very weak. I think it's built up. There's some tendency toward violence, there's an undue use of force, you see, but it can be either the parent can, by example and by teaching, bring it down or bring it up, you see. Some slight tendency one way can become very big if you keep going.
Even a simple physical thing like not touching a hot stove, you can show the consequence of touching the stove. But if you instilled an absolute that you should not touch a stove, it would be a catastrophe, then you've gone too far.
We do overdo, so many people think we overdo the amount of instructions children get, you see, and more primitive tribes, groups, they allow the children much more chance to find out for themselves, which means there'll be that much less arbitrary conclusions, right?
That the mothers haven't even looked at their own fears and anxieties, and this is catching the child, picks it up from the very beginning, not verbally.
Yes, it's the nonverbal. That's a key point. That you see, remember that the real process of thought and felt and impulse, impels and all that is in the tacit nonverbal movement that we can't, like the bicycle. That's really where it happens, right? Now, therefore, that's the most subtle communication, because the attitude, the way things go about, is a direct communication from the nonverbal to the nonverbal, right? And that picks up without, but if that is combined with words, then it really locks, right? You see, so therefore, the right education of children requires that parents be in the right state, you see, and they have more or less reasonable ideas about how to go about it and so on, but
the information that's being imparted is secondary to the attitude.
Yes, but if the two work together, right?
Yeah.
The information which is right won't work if the attitude is wrong, you see.
Well, while I was driving in New York recently, I saw a bumper sticker, which I think it was an attempt of someone to sum it up by saying, stupid people shouldn't breathe. stupid, hopefully in the sense of stupor. Mm-hmm.
But you see, that all the impulses and so on, you see, impulses are, we were just saying, are communicated from the surroundings. The child gets impulses from everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And builds them up, you see, now. So the thing is that it's all going on in this tacit level, and let's see how we can put it, this tacit level is constantly moving. We've built it up, it's conditioned to move to something more comfortable, you know, more pleasant and so on. It creates discomfort and then moves towards something more comfortable. That's the way.
Are you saying that process of moving toward more comfortable thought is something that the parents impose on the child or communicate to the child, or that the mind, for whatever reason, just naturally moves?
Well, there's a certain amount of natural tendency, but it's being built up by the way the parents are working, right?
Because that would seem to me to tie in with this lady's comment that the mind may tend toward forming conclusions, because when you have a conclusion, there's a certain safety within that limited, closed system of the mind. You think you know, and there's knowledge or a safety in that apparent knowledge.
Yes, well, it's not all that strong at the beginning. You see, I think it's just a tendency, and it can either be built up or brought down, you see. But if the child is learning tacitly from the parent that we don't do that sort of thing, then it'll gradually bring it down, you see. Whereas if he's learning from the parent that that's the right way, then it builds up and gets stronger.
Well, absoluteness and conclusions are one of the things that we do transmit to children just by our strength of our convictions and the way we say things. And
yeah.
We build that whole idea into them as part of our...
See, the tendency to move toward comfort, as I said, is meaningful at the physical level. But with thought, it is generally not meaningful, because thought itself makes the discomfort and then moves toward comfort, you see, and by introducing self-deception. Now, therefore, the right way would be for thought to stop making you uncomfortable, you see. Now, we get into the habit of entertaining thoughts that make us uncomfortable, right? And holding to them, you see, rather than going into them and, you see. Now, it's peculiarly enough, it's just the desire for comfort that makes us hold to uncomfortable thoughts, right? Because we don't want to be so uncomfortable as to look at them, and therefore we get stuck with them, right?
Or the fear of losing them.
Yes, well, but generally speaking, we don't want to be, if we have a thought that we suspect is going to make us feel bad, the automatic movement makes us move away from that before we look at it, right? Mm-hmm. So there may be nothing to it at all, but we have already assumed that it's going to be very bad anyway. And therefore we are stuck at there, right?
Well, now when you say not look at it, look at what?
Well, just be aware, be cognizant of what this thought is and how it's affecting the felts and all that, you see.
Okay, so it's not so much in an analysis of thought,
no.
Rather an experiencing of that.
I think that would be spontaneous, you see. I think there is a spontaneous proprioception of thought, very subtle, but it's being destroyed, right?
Yeah.
And you would say, okay, there's a thought that might... It builds up an image that's frightening or uncomfortable, and then you say, no, I mustn't think of that, right? Or you don't even think that, you start moving away, you see. So you can't keep your mind on it, right? If you try to put your mind on it, it moves away, you see, it jumps, attention goes to something else, or you forget, constantly forgetting, right? Constantly getting senses of anesthesia and dullness, right? Right? The brain is producing all that to prevent you from getting into that thought, right? Because the brain is trying to protect you from what it regards as something very bad, right?
That could also happen on a societal level, couldn't it?
Yeah.
I once heard the term psychic numbing used with respect to, say, the nuclear situation.
Yes, it gets numb, you know, it gets, or else it gets very excited about something else instead. It darts, it jumps, and it forgets.
In some sense, we're deeply immersed in that process right now, probably. In that, if I believe in our words, what we're saying, if I believe in this thinking as something tangible that's going to make things all right, I'm present here trying very hard to understand these words and put them together in a way that then will allow me to relax. And that very movement of trying to take hold of these words in this way is what is the stress. It stands in the way of something opening up.
Yeah, you see, it could be said that if we could just listen to the words without stress, you know, then it would work, because these words would then convey a meaning and it would be sensed if it's right, okay. Now the whole system responds to that meaning without any further attempt on our part to do anything, right? You see, this is the important point. Our whole culture teaches us otherwise, but says we're the ones who will do it all, right? Mm-hmm. But you see, it happens. You see that if we can listen to the meaning, so the important thing is to listen to the meaning, right? The meaning provides a sort of a show, a picture, or something of the, you know, and the whole system is acting according to that. Right? And if you find it's incoherent, you have to what?
How can we get coherence with if we don't find out whether your meaning coincides with what we presume the meaning is in our heads? We've got to get some coherence by seeing if we meet in some congruence. If we don't, your meaning can be one thing, and we can have 103 other meanings floating around, and there's no coherence at all.
Yes, well, there's a way out of that. You see that we can suspend, we're going to, just in terms of a dialogue that comes collectively, we can suspend all the meanings, you see, and just simply appreciate the meanings, and the whole, out of this whole thing, truth emerges, you see, and unannounced, right? You see, not that we have chosen it, right? You see that, the difficulty is if I already have some meanings which are closed conclusions, then it rejects the meanings that don't agree and I don't really listen to them. See what I say? I'm going to oppose them and so on. You see, now, if we could have, I'm just saying, if the meaning can come in and all the meanings are together, we'll work out what coherence is. We may have to drop a lot of our meanings, or we don't have to accept them or reject them, but the important thing is that we'll never come to truth unless the overall meaning is coherent. Now, all the meanings of the past and the present are together, and we first have to apprehend them, you see, and just let them be, right? Now, we'll discuss what truth means later, but the first point is that if we allow these meanings, and there is a whole process which moving tacitly, you know, moving which we don't control, and this will bring about order. You see, now, see, we don't trust this. You see, we believe that we have got to control it, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it's very firmly implanted in us. You see, parents have done it. Everybody has done it, right? So, I'm just saying this now for you to consider. Don't accept it or reject it.
What you're really saying is that we're looking for the coherence in the wrong place.
Yeah.
We're looking for the coherence in a chain of words, rather, and it's sort of meaningless. It's hard to understand, but the coherence is not going to be in a sequence of words.
The words are merely conveying a meaning, you see, and now they. See, perhaps we could say that this tacit process, which we don't trust and hardly know about, does actually do the whole thing, right? but we have a picture in which we say it's being done in another way, right?
Is it that we tend to think linearly, and which would involve time, that if you, this is just like riding a bicycle, not a linear.
No.
Process, and we tend to think that way.
No, but it's not linear even as cause and effect, because its cause becomes effect and effect becomes cause, and you can't keep track of that chain, right? And, there is a process going on which is able to handle this, but we don't believe it, right?
See, when you suggest that we find this in this tacit meaning, it's like you've stood me on the edge of a cliff, uh-huh, and you've taken away what I've always used to find meaning, and it's a very threatening suggestion.
Well, yes.
The other day when we were talking about meaning, you had several words, one of which was significance.
Yes.
Significance, and you pointed out, means like a sign pointing towards something. It seems that very often when we use the word meaning, we're talking about something extrinsic to the thing itself. You've been told the meaning of money is this, the meaning of a title and a position and a good job is that you're a good person and so forth. The meaning is something which is, in effect, a conclusion which thought has attached to a situation, an event, whatever. And perhaps in that sense what the lady was asking about, having your meaning, her meaning, uh-huh, our meanings coincide, is asking for various conclusions and thought to coincide, which are all extrinsic to the thing itself. Perhaps that's not at all what you're getting at when you're really looking at meaning is.
Yeah, if you identify this meaning as mine, that meaning as yours, and so on, that's already a level of abstract thought.
Right, it's conclusions and values which are attached to whatever has happened or is happening, mm-hmm, based on the felts and the particular brain's responding to it.
You see, all the meanings are there together. The minute anybody says something, it's your thought, your meaning. It's added to all the other meanings. Even if you say it's mine, it's still yours, you see. The same as if you get my flu bugs, they're yours, right? Really, once you've got them. They're not mine anymore at all, right? You see, so you could say these flu bugs you got are not compatible with some other things you've got in there. And it has to be all worked out inside by the immune system, right?
So are we discussing the difference between symbolic meanings and the chance that there may be, or there already is, or we wouldn't be able to communicate and even be in this room together, that we hold a tremendous amount of what you might call tacit meanings, which even those arise from an even deeper meaning that we may not know.
Yeah, the meaning is basically tacit, and what we can say explicitly is only a very small part of it, you see.
Most of those are symbolic.
Yeah, the words are symbols standing in for something, right?
Which gets back to your saying significance is a sign, it's representing or pointing towards something.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still confused in this dialogue. Are you saying that if we listen to your words, there's some automatic way that your words will be accepted?
No, not just my words. You see, listen to anybody. See, when we come to the idea of dialogue, which we'll come to, you know, everybody's words are on the same base. We have to listen to them all and see what they mean, right?
Well, you just said see what they mean, but earlier you said you don't have to see what they
mean. Well, what
so
I meant.
I don't understand how one learns without seeing what something means.
Yes, but
really
that, but you don't actually do anything to see what it means.
You don't?
Not any conscious willed action. You see, seeing what it means is a natural action.
Only if you have some background. A child of four could not begin to see what it means because it doesn't have enough background to make any coherence out of it.
Yes, well, you have the background. We have the common language, you see. We know the meaning of the language, and from there on, we can see the meaning. Now, if we lack background, we can discuss and find out where we lack it, right? But, see, the first thing is to see, let the process work to see what it means. And if you find it's puzzling, you can ask a question and so on, you see, to build it, to go further, right? The point I wanted to make is seeing what it means is not an action done by an entity called me, right? But it's the natural process of the whole system.
Well, without background, the system's not going to
get. But the system contains background, you see, that's part of the system.
But you call it a system, and you don't want to use the word self, but there certainly is a built-up background of identity. I don't care what you call it.
Well, we'll discuss that, what it means later, you see, but the background contains some information that you need to
That's
understand,
right?
We'll assume that most of that is there. We understand the language and a great many things in common. If some of it is missing, we have to communicate about it, right?
Is the background the conditioning, which is not necessarily bad?
Yeah, the conditioning is all sorts of things. Much of it is necessary, and some of it may be cause of confusion and so on.
So, let me ask a question. It seems like instead of... What is it that you think is missing or you would like to present to the group? It seems like instead of... I would like to hear what you have to say about this meaning thing, or are you just... Because I don't get what you're trying to say when you ask me.
Well, from what I have in my background learned
right.
about learning, uh-huh. it's almost impossible to hear words and put meaning to them that you can store for further use without having all kinds of things happening in the brain, connections, and...
You mean it's almost impossible not to do?
No, it's impossible to do it without some background. If you start with the baby can't do it.
Well, it has a little background that gets it started on.
Right, and we keep building up. Now, if I can't, you know, sometimes, as Dr. Bowman said, there's injury to the brain, and memory does not take place, therefore meaning does not come in.
But isn't the baby does do it by virtue of the fact that it has the capacity to learn.
Little by little.
No.
I don't understand what you're still
trying to
say.
The capacity to learn is inherent there. It doesn't have to learn how to learn.
I was trying to understand Dr. Bohm's specific words about
You can just listen and get the meaning.
Yes, as far as it's naturally, if you don't know the language, you won't get it, right?
Right.
There are some other things you've got to know to get it, right?
Right.
We share. We share most of that in common. I don't think that we lack a common basis for talking about these things. You see, I think we have a good enough basis.
If I sat down with a Kalahari Bushman and watched the sunset, without words, there's a shared meaning.
Yes.
Without knowing the language, there's a shared meaning. I recall the exchange in the Campbell-Moyers dialogues where it came up about the search for the meaning of life. And this idea, this search, and Campbell suggested that it was an illusory search, the search for meaning, the meaning of life, that the meaning was in the living of life.
Yes.
And that's a process, as I envision it or feel it, that's beyond thinking or thought.
Yes, well, I'm glad you brought that up. I think it's a key point, that a very large part of the meaning is not that accumulation, but it is something more fundamental, this tacit process I'm talking about, which we really share. And we share from our very nature, you see, our constitution. We even share it with animals to a considerable extent. And a great deal of it is shared. And a great deal of the most fundamental things can be shared with very little. We need the language, of course, and so on, but without a tremendous background, because the thing we have to share is just not the background.
Right.
You see, the main thing we have to share is not the background, but what is beyond that background, that which is fresh and new, and which is which I hope we'll come to in a more extensive discussion as we go along.
So with the question here is the difference between meanings and myths.
Well, one last thing. For instance, if you wanted to discuss your theories of physics or astrophysics with us.
We couldn't do it, no.
You couldn't do it, right?
No, I agree on that.
Okay.
Yes, but I think that if we want to discuss the sort of thing I'm talking about, we can, because we know enough, we have a common language in that area, and we have some common experience enough for that purpose, and the thing we want to discuss is beyond all that, you see.
That's where my problem is. I don't think we have that much of a common background.
Well,
discussing what you want to discuss.
Well, let's leave the question open then.
We'll
see how we can go, right?
Why don't we be personal then? Bring it back to the individual and say, I don't have enough background to discuss this.
Well, any person may say that for himself or herself, and that's all right. You see, I think maybe in the next hour we should discuss the question of dialogue, because we've sort of come to that now, you see, in a natural way.
Just one more point before we going back to the impulse.
Yeah.
You would discuss the ones that arouse pain.
Yeah.
How about the impulse to pleasure? Seems to me a different type of...
Well, pleasure. That can be equally difficult, because the memory of pleasure is the desire to have it again. And since it often can't be repeated in that way, then there will be something painful felt of not getting that pleasure. And it starts the whole thing going again, right?
David, is there something going on here where we share something and that is fundamental, and we don't have to generate some observer to see if it's okay?
Yes, that's what I'm suggesting. And in the afternoon, I will discuss the whole question of the observer and the observed, and so on, you see, which is part of the whole question, right? But I think we should go to the question of, it seems reasonable at this point to go to the question of dialogue, because that's part of the whole process of how we could share meaning, right? Okay, then we'll have our break now in 15 minutes. Let's try to make it really 15 minutes.